Okay, so hi, welcome to the seminar on Java 3D. We're gonna go over how to do some really cool things with Java and 3D graphics in general in this seminar. And just to give you a taste of, you know, what you can accomplish with this, I wanna show you my final project from last year. So my final project was just a game where you play Rubik's Cube, you can scramble it around, play with it, and have it solve itself. So, you know, you have a cube here, it renders itself in 3D, you can move it around, and you can also do stuff like actually play with it. And it's actually a lot easier to do than with conventional 3D tools like OpenGL that actually require you to interface directly with your computer's video driver. So it's really nice, and it's not actually that hard. So I just want to talk for a second about what the goal of this seminar actually is. You know, the goal of the seminar is not to make you completely proficient with Java 3D or introduce you to all the syntax and stuff like that. Because it's a huge API, like you can spend weeks and months actually figuring out how to do things with it. But what's more important is actually conceptually understanding how 3D graphics work and integrating that with Java 3D to a certain extent. So the goal of the seminar is to be largely conceptual as to how 3D graphics function, and then we'll go over some small examples. I'll point you guys to a couple of good resources where you can actually learn syntax yourself and play around with stuff like this. So I guess the first question then is, you know, how abstractly even do you get something like this to appear on the screen? How do you do 3D graphics? So conceptually, it's actually a lot easier to understand than, you know, going off and coding something like this. Because the way people have built this up is that 3D graphics actually work for a programmer very similar to the way, you know, things work in the real world. It's just about as simple as saying, okay, I have a scene. I'm going to put some objects in that scene. I'm going to specify where those objects are placed. And then you let the computer actually go off and render those objects and give you an image like this that you can play around with. So let's kind of think of an example of this. Say you just have a situation where you want to display a single cube and nothing else on the screen. So you want something like this. Is this big enough, by the way? Yeah, so you have something like this. This is your screen, and that's all you want to display. Well, it looks kind of complicated, right? Because, you know, so far all we've done in this class, at least, is just displaying stuff that's text or images maybe via HTML or whatever. But we've never actually gone over how to create graphics. But the thing is, an interface like Java 3D actually lets you do this very easily. Because all you have to do to generate a cube like this in Java 3D is you have to do some preliminary stuff and say you have a scene and all that. But just putting the cube in is about as simple as saying new cube, insert cube into scene. So it's really straightforward. And then you specify, okay, you know, what the colors of the faces of the cube are and where you want the cube to be spatially with regard to a certain coordinate system. But it's really about as simple as saying, make a cube, insert the cube in the scene. You don't even have to worry about how the cube is made because Java 3D is nice enough to do that for you. So it's really nice and straightforward. But, you know, in terms of what you might want to do with your final project or whatever, it's going to be a little bit more complicated than just, you know, inserting a cube onto the screen and have it statically sitting there, right? You might want to insert the cube at, like, different locations. You might want it to move around. You might want different objects, too. So how do you do something like that? Well, again, Java 3D provides this abstraction layer that hides all the annoying details of doing something like this away from you. So say, even if you wanted to make this a little bit more complicated now and, you know, have a cube, except you want the cube to spin around on its axis. Even for something like this, all you need is maybe two lines of code that, in addition to the code that you wrote to render just this cube here. And that's why Java 3D is really nice. So how do 3D graphics work independent of Java 3D? Well, there's this central concept that you guys need to understand before you can actually go off and do something like this, whether it's draw a cube or draw a cube that's rotating or, like, make something much more complicated than this in a 3D scene. And that concept is the concept of a scene graph. So, you know, we've been studying graphs in this class. You guys looked at trees and tries and maybe, like, implemented a try for your problem set 6. So the concept of a scene graph is not really that different from any of them, really. So what is a scene graph? It's a graph that has certain nodes in it, and each node represents an object. So for something like this, the scene graph would be really, really simple. You just have a root node, and then you'd have one child, and this child would be called the cube. And basically what happens is, when the computer goes off and draws this image, it starts at the root of the scene graph, it goes down to all the children, and it places them one by one on the screen. So you have a nice 3D image without actually doing most of the work yourself. So say now instead you had a scene where you had like one big cube and like multiple small cubes. Or you have a circle maybe here and a triangle. Well, in terms of the scene graph, this is really not that more difficult, right? Because you just have different nodes here, like this is another cube, and this is a circle, and this is your triangle. And basically, then again, what the computer does is it just looks at this graph, it goes all the way down the graph, and it puts each of these objects that you have here, it puts them on the screen. And there's your 3D image. So now what if you wanted to animate things like this here? You want a cube that's rotating around the screen, right? Well, the way you do that is basically when you have 3D graphics, you have, you know, these objects in the scene. But an object is just a collection of points, right? Like for this cube, you've got different surfaces in the cube. Just think about it like you have a cube in front of you. The cube has different surfaces, and it has different edges and like different corners. So to draw the cube on the screen, you actually need to just specify like what the points are for each of the corners. But what about the case where you actually want to do something more interesting, where you want to move the cube around in space? Well, in order to do that, you have this thing called transform objects, which basically act on objects that you place in the scene and move them around. So we'll go into the details of how these work, but right now just kind of get an idea of it conceptually, in that a transform object is just something else that goes into this graph that acts on another object and moves it around. So say you wanted this cube to be rotating in space now. Well, what would the scene graph look like? So yeah, now you have the root of your tree. Transform. So basically what happens now is, when you have a scene graph like this that you've created using Java 3D, basically what the computer does is, in order to draw the image, it goes down, you know, this branch of the tree, and says, okay, well, we start at the root, and now we see a transform object. So everything else that's placed on the screen after this point is going to be rotated or moved about by this transform. So if the transform was, say, like, rotate 90, what this is basically going to do is it's going to go down the tree and rotate the cube by 90 degrees and then display it on the screen. If you change this transform to something else, the cube would get changed to something else. So basically, in terms of, like, say you wanted this cube to be rotating around on the screen, you'd create a scene graph such that the transform specified by this object changes continuously with time. And then as the transform changes, the cube rotates, because this transform is being applied to the cube every time it's drawn. So that's kind of just a broad idea of how a scene graph works. But, you know, I'm sure you guys are all wondering right now, how the hell do we actually put these objects into the scene? Where do we go from here? So before we actually go into the details of this in terms of Java 3D, it's important to kind of get a firm basis on what object-oriented programming is, because Java is a largely object-oriented language, and Java 3D in particular relies on object-oriented concepts immensely to actually do stuff like this. So I've been using the word object rather loosely for the past 5 minutes or so. So I've been saying, you know, this cube is an object, and this circle is an object, and the triangle is an object, and we're just putting them in this tree, and then the computer goes off and draws it for us, right? But the thing is, an object in itself is also a very powerful programming construct. And it very much models the objects that we have in the real world. So in terms of this program here now, let's actually go back to this. Say you actually wanted to draw something like this on the screen using Java 3D based on what we've talked about before. So in the examples we discussed, you know, we had a cube that was put on the screen, and the cube was rotated or whatever by a certain amount based on, you know, this transform object. So now you have a Rubik's cube, which is a lot more complicated than just a normal cube, right? But if you look at it, you'll notice that it's just composed of, you know, many different cubes, 26 cubes to be precise. So this right here is one cube, this bit. So that's one cube, and that's another cube, and that's another cube. So you have 26 different cubes on the screen. So, you know, it would kind of be a pain to have to go off and create each cube individually yourself by writing, like, separate lines of code to draw the cube, state what the colors are, state what position it's in, and move it there yourself. So, you know, it would be nice if you just had one kind of object that we call the cube, and we could create the object 26 different times just using a loop and move it to different parts of the screen, which is kind of, you know, the intuitive way in which a lot of people would do it as opposed to writing 26 different lines of code, because writing 26 different chunks of code to draw 26 different cubes doesn't really scale, does it? Like, say you had a huge, like a much bigger cube than this. So, well, how do you actually do something like that? So if you think about C, right? In C, we had structs, and structs were a way of encapsulating different values together into one sort of group. So when we did, you know, the dictionary or the spell checker, each node in the linked list was a struct. And, like, two things were encapsulated in that, in each node. One was the value of the node, and the other thing was a pointer to the next node. So in that sense, an object is not much different than a struct. It's just a way of encapsulating many different things together so that you can create them many times over without doing your work multiple times. So the fundamental difference, really, between a struct and an object in a language like Java is that, at least the way we use structs in C, was that you could only encapsulate data in them. So each struct had many different, like, fields and values. Like, you could have ints and chars and all sorts of other things in the struct, but you couldn't really put anything else in them. And say you had a struct and you wanted to modify the value of the elements in the struct, you would have to have a separate function that takes a struct as an input and then modifies the value of the struct and then returns the struct again, and you'd have to reassign it, which is kind of painful. So object-oriented programming basically provides us a really, really nice way to encapsulate both data and functions together into one object. So for a cube like this, I could say that each cube has three different values, like the values of the colors on each of its sides, in addition to, like, values for, you know, the face of the Rubik's cube on which that tiny cube is, like a whole bunch of different things that can be encapsulated into one object. But I can also have functions in it. So say I was doing a twist on the cube, like if I twisted a face like this. So if I twist a face like that, right, I can have a function that actually sits within that object itself, and as opposed to passing each cube, little cube on the face that was just twisted to the function directly, I can just do something that looks much cleaner like this. So I'm going to show you an example line of code now. So say in C you created a struct called little cube or cube that just contained the data needed to draw a cube on the screen. And now you wanted to rotate the cube by 90 degrees. So the way you need to do that with a struct is actually go into the struct and change the different fields that specify how the cube is drawn and make sure it gets rotated by 90 degrees, right? Well, the way you would do it in C would probably be you define a function, something like rotate cube by 90, and you'd need to pass the function an argument, which is the cube that you want to modify, right? So you do something like this. So, yeah, just like down here. So you'd probably have a function that takes a cube or a struct, and it'll, like, rotate it by 90 degrees. But the function would take the struct as an argument, right? And you'd probably have to get messy with pointers because you'd want, you know, the struct to be passed by reference, not by value, so that when the function returns, it's actually modified. And that's just a little bit painful. And once you get to using applications that are much bigger than what we've written in this class, it's really annoying to have to deal with pointers and, like, passing structs around and to different functions and stuff like that. It just gets messy. And it's also messy in that you have a huge set of functions, and you've not grouped them in any nice way. They're just, it's really unwieldy because you'll have, like, hundreds and hundreds of functions just floating around in your code when you don't need all of them for everything, right? So object-oriented programming is nice in the sense that you can encapsulate functions within the objects to which they apply. So it's like if you had a struct and it had certain fields and you had a function that modified the struct in some way, well, that function is only ever going to be used with the struct, right? So say if you had a function that took a cube and modified it in some way, the function will only be used with that cube. So it would be much nicer if you could just put the function in the bundle of the cube and, yeah, not be able to use the function in any other context. It provides a really nice way of organizing things. So then the way this would work then is, say you now had this cube again, and you've called it little cube 1, and you want to rotate it by 90 degrees. The syntax changes slightly. It becomes something like this. Yeah, so it's like very similar to the way you access data in a struct. You'd say something like, you know, little cube 1 dot left face, if, you know, left face was an int or whatever. Or little cube 1 dot right face, if right face was an int. But now in this case, you're just saying, you know, little cube 1 dot rotate by 90, which basically means, okay, rotate the cube by 90 degrees. And now this object is rotated. So it's a much cleaner way of thinking of things, because even when you have an object in the real world and you want to alter it, you don't think of it in terms of like passing the object to a function and then getting the object back and, you know, the object now taking on this new state. You just think of the object and you think of an action on the object, and that action just modifies it directly. So it's kind of like that. It's a much more intuitive way of thinking about things, and it's very natural to the way you'd actually think of objects in the real world, which is why it works so well with a 3D graphics application. Because in the 3D graphics application, you just have objects and you've put them in the scene, and you want to do stuff with them, and it's just a much cleaner way of doing it. Okay. So, also, you know, when you did your dictionary program and stuff like that, right? If you use tries, you probably found it really painful that every time you created a whole bunch of nodes in the try, you'd have to go through and initialize them and set the pointers to null or whatever. It's just really stupid and an annoying way to do things. So it would be a lot cleaner and nicer if every time you declared a node, it was immediately initialized. And again, objects allow you to do that, because when you create an object in a language like Java or C++, you can specify a constructor, which says, you know, it's a function that initializes the object in some way. So every time you create a new object, it's automatically initialized to whatever values you want it to have. So unlike, you know, with the try that you might have written in the dictionary homework, you don't have to actually like loop through all the damn nodes you created every time you create them and like initialize them and do messy stuff like that. It does it automatically because you've built up all the groundwork already. So that's kind of why object-oriented programming is useful, and it's especially useful in this context. So yeah, let's go through some examples now with Java 3D specifically. So, and you'll have to tell me if like you can see stuff on the screen, but. So here we have a really simple program, and basically what it does is it draws a cube on the screen. Let's play it and see what it does. Yeah. No. Yeah, so if you see, now you just have a cube on the screen. It's not rotated or anything, but it's just drawn. And we'll look over the code, and you'll see that it's just like 20 lines of code overall, of which 2 lines are used to draw the cube. So, yeah, this is the method that actually goes off and creates this scene and puts a cube on it. So I'm not going to step through these functions one by one, because there's enough data out there for you guys to go and learn that yourself as and when you need to. But we'll go over the relevant line of code that actually draws the cube. And it's this stuff here. As you'll see, it's just straightforwardly 2 lines of code. You have a scene graph, which is what we talked about earlier. And all you're saying is, okay, now add into the scene a color cube. The size should be 0.4, which is just a scaling factor by which you scale the cube. So it's really as simple as that. Like, you don't even have to go off and write the routine that draws the cube for you. Java 3D already has that inbuilt, and it does this. So it's really, really powerful, because you've got 3D graphics now with 20 lines of code, and that's about it. So, you know, this is a little bit less interesting because you just have one cube on the screen, right? Not exactly what you're going to do your final project on. So what if you want to rotate the cube a little bit, kind of make it like that so you can actually see multiple faces of the cube? Again, that in itself is pretty straightforward in Java 3D. Here, we go with the example. Yeah, so now you have a cube, and it's rotated. Again, all we did here was add two lines of code, and let's kind of go over that. Okay, so I'm going to draw this out. Again, very much like we had here, where we had this cube that was rotated in a certain way so you can see all faces. Like, the scene graph for this is still really straightforward. It's just you have a transformation that acts on the cube, and you know, you put the cube in the scene, you put the transformation in the scene, and that's it. Like, Java 3D just goes down this path and, like, draws all the objects that are in here. So when it sees the transform object, it says, okay, every child of this and everything lower than this should be rotated by, like, 90 degrees. So since the cube is the only thing below this, it gets rotated in a certain manner, and it appears like this. So, you know, if we added another cube and we put it like this as a child, that cube would also, like, show up rotated. But if you actually did something like this, where you added the cube here, then the cube would show up like the first one we saw, not rotated in any way. Because when it actually renders this scene, it's going to go down the scene graph and say, okay, well, let's draw this cube. There was no transform before it, so just draw it, you know, how it naturally is. Let's go down here. Okay, we see a transform. Well, everything below this should be rotated by whatever was specified in the transform. Okay, so the cube gets rotated, and it gets drawn on the screen. So it's really quite intuitive. And it's also really powerful because, you know, when you have 3D graphics, like, say you have a car in a computer game, right? The car is made up of multiple little, like, components. So there's, like, probably a separate thing for the wheel and a separate thing for the body of the car and, like, for the guy sitting inside it and all of that. But you know, you want all of them to move together, so you don't want to have to specify separate transforms for each of them and keep updating each of them individually. But, you know, with a scene graph like this, you can just do something like, okay, we have the root, we have a transform, and now, like, every object that's part of the car descends from this. So, you know, if you have a game where the car is moving forward as you drive or whatever, everything's going to move forward without, like, the programmer actually having to bother with, you know, changing each one of these individually. So it's a really clean way of thinking about things. So how did this happen in Java 3D? So again, this is the part of the code where we're actually going to create this rotation. So Java 3D actually has some really nice inbuilt objects that you can use. So there's an object called the transform 3D object, which basically creates a transform. Because conventionally, the way programmers used to deal with transforms is they would use three-dimensional matrices and actually construct the matrices themselves, which is kind of ugly. Because, okay, if you think about it, each of these things in the cube, right, is a point in three-dimensional space. So if you represent it as a vector, it's just, like, it's got an X component, a Y component, and a Z component. So if you want to transform all the points in this cube in a certain way, then what you would do is you'd multiply it with a 3x3 matrix. And the result of that would give you a new vector, except this one would be transformed. So old So say you actually wanted to increase the size of the cube by 2, right? You want to scale it by a factor of 2, make it twice as big. Then the way programmers would conventionally do this is actually go off and construct this matrix themselves. And, you know, the matrix would just be the identity matrix multiplied by 2. So it would be 2, 0, 0, 0, 2, 0. So every time a programmer wanted to transform, he'd actually have to, like, go look up his linear algebra textbook, figure out what the transform would be, and then apply it individually to each point in the space, which is just really, really painful, right? So again, Java 3D, like, provides a way to abstract that away really nicely. So yeah, you have this transform 3D object, it's called rotate, and you just construct, you know, you've constructed it. So now you have this object. You have another object that's called temp rotate. So you basically have two rotation objects. And what's happening internally in these objects is there's a matrix, just like the one we saw, except you don't have to worry about it because Java 3D is abstracted away. And then because Java 3D is an object-oriented language, it actually encapsulates a whole bunch of really nice methods with this object. So there's a method that says rotate x, which basically means, okay, rotate this object around the x-axis by like a certain amount. There's another method called rotate y that actually rotates the object around the y-axis by a certain amount. So basically what it's doing is it's taking this matrix that's contained in rotate and temp rotate, and it's applying these transforms to them so that eventually these matrices change to useful things. Okay, so now you have matrices. What do you do with them? So basically you create a new object in the scene graph. And you construct it using the matrix you've created. So if you see what's going on here, like, don't worry about the semantics of this or whatever. Like, what's really happening is you're saying, okay, I want an object in my scene graph. That's what's meant by transform group. So I want an object in my scene graph that, you know, has this transformation, the matrix that we just constructed. And I'm going to put it in the scene graph. And then I want a child of that to be a cube. So basically what's happening is we have this cube, and it's a child of this matrix that we've created. So when the cube is drawn, the matrix is going to be applied to every point in the cube so that it appears to be rotated by a certain amount. And what we get then is this. This thing right here. So it's pretty much the same object. This is the same object that was rendered as this time, except now because we constructed this matrix using Java 3D, the object got rendered in a way that we can actually see all three faces of it. And again, it took like three lines of programmer code. And admittedly, you'll have to spend some time, you know, looking up the Java 3D reference or whatever and figuring out what functions you'll use to do stuff like this. But once you've done that, it's a lot more straightforward than actually going off and creating matrices yourself and like managing arrays, you know, which is really painful, especially in a language like C, where even to create a matrix, you have to probably go off and like make a malloc call or something like that, which is just painful. So yeah, this is a nice way of doing that, and now the matrix was rotated. And if we actually go back and look at this Rubik's Cube, it's constructed in a really similar way. Like, each of those little cubes was created using a loop that just looped over 26 times and created a new cube, assigned different colors to each cube, and went and set it off in different directions. And then beyond that, like, each little cube also had its own, you know, matrix associated with it. And every time, like, a twist is carried out like this, basically there's a tiny section of code that goes through all the 26 cubes and says, you know, is this cube on the face that is rotated? If the cube is on the face, well, let's change the matrix associated with by a certain amount. And that's just how it gets twisted. So again, it's really like, it's a lot more intuitive and a lot more like the way you'd actually perceive it in the real world than you'd have to do it in a language like C. Just because Java abstracts everything away from you. It's all under the hood. Okay. Let's go over another example. Now, like, this is what we saw earlier was kind of boring because still, you have a cube. You can view it from an interesting angle, but you can't really, like, it's not moving. It's not doing anything interesting. And I'm sure a lot of you in your final projects will probably want to, like, have animations or things like that going on. So how would you do that? Let's see another example. Okay. Okay, so yeah, now we have a cube here and it's moving around, right? And again, you'll see that Java 3D just made this possible using five extra lines of code. So if you think about how you'd have to do it if you didn't have like the stuff that Java 3D built up, say we had a cube on the screen, but you wanted it to be rotating, like, what do you think would be an interesting way to do it, like, given just C-style stuff? So, like, the way I would do it if I was using C is I would draw the cube, and I'd have a loop that goes through, like, say, 1,000 times or something like that. Each time it goes through, it modifies the matrix associated with the cube by a tiny amount. So it rotates that matrix just a little bit more. And I'll probably put a sleep in there somewhere that makes sure that, you know, it doesn't happen too quickly or whatever. But again, that requires a lot of programmer work, right? Because you need to write this loop, and you need to make sure that, you know, the sleeps are timed properly and all of that. Again, Java 3D provides a really nice way to do this without worrying about any of that yourself. So this is almost exactly like what we had before, except now we have a new transform group, but it's still the same as before. It has a matrix in it, except what we're doing here is we're saying, you know, allow the matrix in this transform group to be written at runtime, like dynamically. So it's not like earlier where you just applied the transform to the cube and it was displayed once and then you couldn't change it ever again. This says, okay, you know, the program is going to dynamically modify this and we'd like the matrix in this group to be modified dynamically. Then what we do is, you know, we add this matrix to the scene graph. We add the cube as its child, which is kind of like the same structure that we had earlier. The only thing now is that we also have an object called an alpha. And basically, an alpha is a nice Java 3D way to say that, okay, I want this object to rotate, and I want it to do so about once every, like, 4 seconds. So just, like, look at the comments, and you'll see what's going on. It's pretty self-explanatory. So yeah, just, like, these 2 or 3 lines of code here are adequate to get the cube moving around. So it says that, okay, we want a new alpha object that causes the matrix to interpolate itself, like to rotate itself once every 4 seconds or so. And again, you don't have to actually go in and manually change the matrix or anything. It does it all for you, and you can just sit back and watch it happen. So again, like, there's all this mechanism that's built up that makes it really, really easy for you to go and do cool stuff like this. Okay. So we're going to go through one more example, and it's kind of crucial because it highlights a very important aspect of, like, these scene graphs and how the matrices are actually applied to your objects in your scene. Okay. So again, we have a rotating cube, except this time the cube has been, you know, rotated so that you can see all faces of it, and then it's spinning around after that. So I'm going to draw the scene graph for this, actually, just so you kind of get an idea of how it works. So you have the root of the scene. So now if you see in this graph, there are actually 2 transforms that precede the cube itself. So what happens is the first thing that we do is we actually take the cube and we make it visible so that we make all 3 faces of the cube visible. So we rotate it so that you can, basically it goes from this state to this state. So that's the first step, that's the first transform that we apply. And then the second transform is pretty much the same as before. What it does is it just spins the cube around and it does that like once every 4 seconds or so. Or, like, whatever it is. So, basically, when this scene is being rendered in real time, what happens is it starts at a root, it goes down, it applies this transform. Then it applies this one. So it takes the matrix in here, and it multiplies it by the matrix in here. And then you have this new matrix that encapsulates both these transforms, and that's what's being applied here. So we've now effectively had 2 transforms on the cube. And again, like, we didn't have to worry about any of the matrix multiplication or any of that ourselves. Again, the way things used to be done with 3D graphics was that the programmer would create the matrices himself separately, and then he'd have to actually go in and, you know, multiply the 2 matrices and then multiply, like, that combined matrix by each point, which is, again, kind of painful, right? So this provides a really cool way to do something like this really easily. But things could go wrong if you don't actually think carefully about the order of things in your graph. So say we actually swap this around now, and we made this the second transform. So this is the thing that spins, and this is just the visible. So even a seemingly inconspicuous change like this will greatly affect the behavior of the overall program, and we'll see why. Here, I'll like change it right now, and see what's happening. So if you see here, the way it's been set up is that you have the root, and then the root has the child that's the rotation object, and then that has the child that's the spin object, which is how we, you know, said it was earlier. But if I actually like modify this order and make this, and now I'm adding the cube right at the bottom of it all. If we do this, then we're going to end up with completely different behavior. Yeah. So compare this with what we had earlier, which was... yeah. Well... yeah, that was the first case, and that's the second case. So you see that just changing the order in which the matrices were multiplied and the order in which you put things in the scene graph greatly affects the output of what you have on the screen. So you have to think about that really very carefully when you work on Java 3D for your final project, because the scene graph is a very powerful tool. It lets you do a lot of things without actually worrying about how the matrices are being multiplied under the hood. But if you screw around with the order of things in the scene graph, then it's highly likely that you won't get what you really want. So it's important to think of that. And okay, so that's pretty much most of the examples that, you know, I wanted to cover today. But just in general, so you know, even something like this, where you move around all these objects with your mouse, is really simple in Java 3D. It just involves two extra lines of code. Because Java 3D has a nice object called mouse rotate, and basically, okay, so we have 26 different little cubes here, right? So all I had to do to get the mouse to move around and like to get all these things to move around with the mouse was I had my root object. I had a mouse object. And I had all the little cubes as children of it. And basically, using two lines of JavaScript, of Java code, you can say, okay, this mouse object should be such that whenever the user clicks and drags, everything gets rotated. Just two extra lines of code, and you can get that. So it's really nice, and in fact, I can actually show you how straightforward it is. Yeah, so now you have a cube that can be rotated, you know, using my mouse. I'm moving it around. And all I had here now is you have, you know, the root object. You have the rotation object. You're saying you want the matrix in this object to be read and to be written. So you're setting capabilities, basically. You're saying, okay, we have a matrix in this object. It's transforming this cube, but I want that matrix to be read and to be written. And you just have an object called the mouse rotate object. You say, okay, this object is going to act on the matrix that acts on the cube. And you say, yeah, like, don't worry about anything after that. But basically, it's just these two lines of code that do that. So you're saying, when the user clicks and drags his mouse, the corresponding matrix should be changed. And that's pretty much what it does. Like, when you click and drag your mouse, corresponding matrix changes. It's just really as straightforward as that. And yeah, like... oh, yeah. Like, just like this. So what's happening under the hood is every time your mouse moves, it's going to go in and it's going to read the matrix for this cube. It's going to check the direction which your mouse moved, multiply the matrix correspondingly, and then put that matrix back in the graph. So now the cube is changed by, like, it's rotated by a different amount. And even that in itself, if you think about it, if you had to implement something like that in C without the, you know, stuff that's been built up for you here, would probably take like 10 to 12 hours just figuring out like how to get the mouse to move in the right direction, or how to get like how the matrix change should correspond to the way your mouse moves. And it's really nice because someone's gone and done that for you, and you can just use this and focus on more important things for your final project. So yeah, that's about it. I want to show you guys a really good resource for programming in Java 3D. So if you go to Google and you search for Java 3D, like the first link that shows up, the Java 3D API, you would have to... So there's the references, which are always useful because you can look around for different functions and stuff like that, which is in the release specification. But also if you go to Google and you search for Java 3D tutorial, you're going to get this, the first link. Yeah, and this is basically a book. It's about 300 pages or so. And it's a completely comprehensive reference to like how to use Java 3D. There's detailed examples that go over all the stuff we saw today itself. Like, it starts with just simply drawing one cube to the screen and then like rotating it or whatever. It also goes through a pretty detailed discussion of how scene graphs work and, you know, how you should construct your scene graphs. All the kind of different things you can do with Java 3D. There's a lot of good advice in there. And it's a very, very readable book. So if you invest the time and actually like go through even the first two chapters of this, you probably will do everything you need for your final project. And it will probably save you a lot more time. You know, like, basically, if you read this book, you're saving on time that you would have otherwise spent, you know, Googling around for things. And that's just generally inefficient. So I'd highly recommend that you use this. Yeah, that's about it, really. Oh, yeah. So if you actually decide to use Java 3D for your final project, both now and I don't know how long this video is going to last, but if it's ever used in like other instances of the class, you should always email me with questions, just because I spent like ridiculous amounts of time both in reading period and like during winter break last year, like wrestling with Java 3D and figuring out stuff. So if you feel like you don't want to waste the time like actually like figuring out something that's painful and, you know, you don't quite know how to do, just email me and I'll probably be able to, like, tell you how to do it much quicker than you can look it up. So, yeah, definitely do that. And, yeah, Java 3D is fun. Play around with it, even if you're not doing a final project on it, but you can definitely, like, screw around with this and have a good time. Just because you can, as David says. Okay, so, yeah, we're back. I just want to show you guys something that's really cool and highlights how easy object-oriented programming can make things. And, you know, while you watch this, think about how many lines of code it would take to do this in C, and know that it took maybe 250 lines of code to do this component in my final project in Java. So, you know, I showed you guys how to play with the cube, but you can also scramble it and hit this little solve button here, and it goes off and tries and solve it for you. And the way it does it, you know, as you'll see, if you're interested in how to solve a Rubik's cube, it's going to solve the first layer. So now that's done. It's going to go ahead and try and solve the second layer now. So that's done. Now it's going to go and solve the back face. Yeah, and now it's going to put it all together. Yep, so about 350 lines of code, and think of how you do that in C. I honestly don't think it's even possible, just because you'd get so bogged down with like actually like doing stupid things like memory management or whatever. So yeah, it's really cool, and this is why I love object-oriented programming. And if you're interested in any of this also, just as an aside, take CS51. Yeah, so that's all.